it's always an opportunity when things are hard. You know, when there is a lot of capital out there, it's easy to solve problem with capital. When you have a lot of investors chasing you and putting money in your company, you can throw money at any kind of trouble and any kind of problem and then have a simple solution. And that kind of at some level goes against the nature of innovation. Innovation usually comes and born out of necessity. And to that sense, now is actually a time for everybody, from investors and entrepreneurs, to when they think about a business model, when they think about a technology, when they think about a company, to think of, okay, now with this new environment, how can we be more innovative than before?
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Today we're talking to Ali Farhanji, who is the Managing Director at DHVC in Palo Alto. DHVC is an early stage tech and life science fund with more than $650 million under management and more than 100 companies in its portfolio. The fund invests in a variety of areas, including enterprise, consumer, fintech, and healthcare. Investors and entrepreneurs are tied together in an arrangement that, if you get it right, benefits both sides. The pandemic has changed the landscape for everyone, but the tie between investors and entrepreneurs and what they want from each other remains the same. In this episode, Ali discusses how, now that most of us are doing business remotely by Zoom, some things have gotten easier and some have gotten harder. In a parallel sense, some entrepreneurs who already make up part of an investor's portfolio might enjoy a stronger connection with their backers who need them. While for startup founders, just seeking their first round, life has gotten harder, but not impossible. Ali has advice on how founders looking for seed funding might be able to leverage their personal networks to build trust and forge connection with investors. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Google Podcasts. Thank you, Ali, for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Christine. Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
And it's so funny because we were talking about having you give a talk at UCSF a couple months ago, and never in my mind that, you know, we had to do the virtual way, but here we are. I'm glad that we still can offer to talk in a different setting. But so maybe before we start, you are the managing director for DHVC. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background, how you end up working at DHVC. What's your path?
Absolutely.
And what's your role at DHVC?
So I actually grew up outside the U.S. I came to U.S. for college and studied engineering as an undergrad. After that, I went to work for a consulting company, and that was the first time coming from an engineering background that I was working with healthcare industry. So in a consulting role, I was working with companies in healthcare industry, insurance companies, medical device companies, and providing them as part of our team advice on how they can improve operations, how they can improve other aspects of their business, marketing, sales, and so on. And that was the first interaction that I had with incredible people that work in the healthcare industry. And you can see many examples of that, of course, during these times, and being one of the largest part of the GDP of the U.S. Following that, I really developed that interest in healthcare. And after finishing business school, I knew I wanted to work in an area that has impact in terms of working with healthcare entrepreneurs and innovators. And that's how I basically connected to DHVC. So DHVC is an early stage venture firm, as you mentioned, based in Palo Alto, California, and invest in early stage startups in enterprise, consumer, and healthcare startups. So for the audience that's interested, if you go to our website, dh www.ali.vc. You can see the list of companies, some featured investments listed there, as well as our contact information if you'd like to get in touch. So for investments that we have in earlier stage, so that basically means we are investing in companies that are maybe just a couple of years old. So these are companies that are raising seed stage or Series A or sometimes Series B investments. And we basically participate or lead those investment rounds and partner with the founders and the team in their journey. And that's the part of the job that gets me the most excited, that you are basically with the founders through their journey. Now, particularly in healthcare, there is obviously a lot of impact that you can have as a startup. You can improve patients' lives by being an innovator in drug discovery and bringing a new drug to the market, or bringing a new diagnostics platform to the market, or having a digital health service. So these are different areas, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of these today, and very exciting area to be in.
So maybe for some of the audience, you mentioned those are all, you cover a broad range of technology, from, you know, technology to healthcare, but, you know, for the purpose of this audience, many of them probably more interested in the healthcare side. But maybe you can tell us more about the size of the fund and what stage you guys usually invested in, and what's the check size that you guys usually invested in.
So we are currently investing out of our, we have several funds. Our current fund is a $3 million fund that we're investing from. And as an early stage investor, we typically try to invest in companies that are below 100 or 200 million valuation, preferably lower the better. And the check sizes that you have, well, nowadays, at least before the pandemic, the size rounds could be very large. So you can have seed or Series A rounds that are $30, $40, $50 million. So we still participate in those or lead those investments with check sizes from anything as low as 500K up to 10, 12 million. Sector focus, we basically invest across all of healthcare. So that's therapeutics, which includes drug discovery and other related areas, as well as diagnostics, diagnostics platform, as well as medical tools and research tools, and digital health services and software related to healthcare delivery.
Right. So I know that you recently have deals that you've closed, but that's on the Q1. It looks like, you know, you guys are still active, at least, you know, Q1. And can you tell us more about what's your projection for Q2 and Q3 in terms of your investment activities?
Yeah, definitely. We still see a lot of activity in Q1. I think some reports that recently published by NVCA, National Venture Capital Association, and Q1, the number of deals, surprisingly, was comparable year over year to last year. So I think overall about $7 billion that was invested in life sciences. And globally, there were about 8,000 venture deals. And those were slightly just lower, maybe 4 or 5% year over year compared to 2019. And that basically tells that there is maybe a delayed reaction into venture and you know, other investment areas when it comes to what is the impact of the pandemic. I think of deals, in terms of the investment deals or even partnerships, M&A type of deals that were already in the pipeline, so getting into 2020 or already in the pipeline. And as the pandemic hit in February and March, those deals basically kind of went through the process, maybe online, some part of it, instead of being in person, but still we're able to be closing those deals. So
do you think even for the M&A, especially company who are doing the acquisition, do they have to manage the PR in terms of, because right now with the uncertainties in the economic, and they might have to furlough employees, do you think they hold off in the M&A announcement? Or do you see that?
Yeah, I can mention a couple of examples in our portfolio. One example in our healthcare portfolio, a company called CG Oncology, that's developing therapeutics based on oncolytic virus assets they have. And they announced a partnership, a sizable $140 million partnership with a Japanese pharmaceutical company called Kissei Pharma Pharmaceutical. And that deal was almost had no impact, from pandemic, in the sense that the conversation started quite a while ago, and that conversation went through even though with the pandemic situation, and it was announced as was previously planned. And so it was a partnership that involved investment as well as milestone payments and basically acquisition of some royalty rights, acquisition of IP and some royalty rights. I think from that perspective, that shows that there were companies that what they were planning from before, at least from what was already budgeted in their Q1, they already went ahead and did those announcements, did those deals. We had another company, not in healthcare, but in a consumer sector, a company called Tubi, which is a video on demand platform, kind of a Netflix, but with advertisements. So the viewer don't pay anything and they just watch advertisements instead of having to pay for subscription. And that company actually, because of, we're already was seeing a lot of demand for services and was growing very fast. But even with the pandemic, as people are watching more movies and TV shows at home, they saw even more adoption of the service. And that company was recently acquired by Fox. And that was a close to $500 million acquisition. And it was announced that and was basically closed and as it was planned before. So I think those companies and those deals, whether in healthcare or some other areas that were in the pipeline, still go through maybe with some hiccup, but a lot of founders and CEOs were able to close that. Going to Q2 and Q3, I think there will be a lot of adjustment. So basically budgeting for, and many companies, you know, they have their fiscal year ending kind of end of the spring or sometime later in the fall. So now they're getting into basically budgeting their following year. And they're taking into account what's going to be the impact of the pandemic. So the CapEx is going to be dramatically different. There's no question in that. So from potential acquirers, from partnerships, there's going to be a reevaluation of the priorities, especially when it comes to the impact of what can be spent on the workforce and the labor versus what can be spent on capital. Given the market situation and you know, how harder it is to raise capital in the capital in the capital markets, I think there's going to be a headwind definitely for people that are looking into those type of partnerships or acquisition deals. So that is unfortunately the situation that's going to probably last for some time.
Yeah, so it's definitely a very time of uncertainties right now. And I think I mentioned to you were mentioning that a lot of the deal that, you know, got finished or concluded is because there's that was in the beginning that has been processed. And you also mentioned that you're still, you know, seeing a lot of the company, you meet the companies, see the pitches, meet the company online thanks to Zoom and other platform. How do you, you know, do you see an uptick of the companies that you are looking for funding? And also, how do you do your due diligence in this funny time?
Yeah, there is definitely more, in, if not the same, more interest in funding for startups, both from investors and entrepreneurs. So we see that there are a lot of entrepreneurs that at the early stage and growth stage are looking to raise funds. And then there is also a lot of investors that are basically willing to invest the capital, the dry powder they have. The matching process has gotten different and harder. So the matching process, which is a very organic process. When you think about early stage investing, the relationship between the investor and entrepreneur is going to be a long-term relationship, and there has to be a very good match between the two to basically have that relationship for a long time. And those type of relationship and comfort that you can get on both sides obviously would be much easier obtained when you have personal meetings and you can meet in the office and you can meet the entrepreneur in their office and or can meet the investor in their office and so on. So with the transition to the online channels, basically for meeting for the first time on Zoom meetings and giving a pitch to investors over a video call or over a online meeting or a lot of the online demo days and so on that you have, that is becoming harder. The good news is, I think, that you see the inclination from investors and entrepreneurs to actually be much more active responding to, for example, cold emails or making sure that they're available for video calls. So that's the good news. So on a net basis, actually, I would say that our company, and I know this from other venture companies as well, that you see even more potential pitch meetings as compared to before, because now you're much more effective kind of in your day schedule. You can have many of these video calls scheduled during the day, and you don't have to travel and you don't have to go outside. And so obviously just more efficiency and time. But at the same time, while that first step of the process is more efficient, that step of the process, which involves then getting comfortable and developing that relationship with the entrepreneur and entrepreneur with the investor, that has become obviously more challenging. And so that is something that we are kind of dealing through as dealing with it as we getting used to this new environment. And I think it takes some experimentation and takes some effort from both sides, investors right. and entrepreneurs, to make it happen.
Well, as you said, it takes some time to build that relationship anyway. So maybe by the times the relationship is built online, then the whole shelter in place is being lifted, and then everything will be ready.
Exactly. So there is a that planning that's very uncertain. I mean, I know venture, it's a long-term, as you know, it's a long-term asset class. So you usually hold these equities that you hold in private companies for a long time. So that basically means that if the pandemic and this economic ramification lasts for, let's say, 2-3 years, that still would be shorter than the time frame for many venture investors. But that being said, I think people are kind of going through an adjustment period and kind of assessing where's the bottom of the market, is the fundraising is going to be generally as was before, or there's going to be less allocation to, let's say, venture capital class of investments. And but once that adjustment is made, and may take a quarter or two to get to that, I think venture as a long-term investor, as the long-term investment, both on the part of the investor and the entrepreneur, is going to remain a relatively unchanged asset class and investment area, because on both sides, determined entrepreneur that they know they have a unique technology, unique business model, a unique scientific breakthrough that they want to pursue, and on the investor side, that they want to invest in those type of determined entrepreneurs, that is a longer term relationship than what this pandemic and its economic ramification would be.
I think everybody, what I found is everybody's adjusting and adapting to the new tools and what's available. And I always think during challenging time, that's when everybody get more creative. What are some of the creative way that you see entrepreneurs approach in trying to get a hold of capital, if you know of any that you can share?
So to your question, Christine, about... But the fundraising, right? How people fundraise. I think if you look at the capital that was raised actually by venture in the Q1, it was about $20 billion, I think, what was reported. So a lot of dry powder to be invested. At the same time, what is kind of the first priority for, I would say, all the venture investors is to make sure their existing portfolio is doing okay, and whatever they can do to help the portfolio companies is almost the priority number one for the venture investors. So from the capital that venture investors have, I think many investors now think of, okay, I may need to reserve more capital because my existing portfolio probably not going to be able to raise capital as fast as they wanted or right. as broadly as they wanted from new investors. So I have to step up. I have to step up and double down and invest more in my existing portfolio. And that basically what that means is, okay, so there's less capital available for me to invest in new ventures and new companies. So that makes it a little bit challenging for new ventures to raise money. I think companies that have already raised and have a base of investors that have backed them before, they will be better positioned to go through and weather through the situation as they can rely on their existing investors to invest, you know, double down again, invest more in the companies. For the first time fundraising, the companies that are raising for the first time in a seed round or a pre-seed round, I think those are going to be the hardest one in terms of the amount of effort that it takes to find the right investors. And you do want to make sure that you are finding the right investor and not just raising money for the sake of having the money in the bank, and you want to have that relationship with the right investor in the long term. I think those have to be done with more determination. So one of the things that I tell the companies that reach out to me is definitely, you know, try to find additional connections or additional introductions as a way to develop that relationship that otherwise you develop in person. So if I get an email, let's say from a CEO of one of my portfolio companies that tells me, hey, Ali, I chatted online with some entrepreneur and I think they have a really new and great product or a service that's going to be a good fit as an investment with what you guys do, then I'd be very excited. Basically, that interim connection, that warm introduction, helps a lot to develop that mutual trust between the founder and the investor. Same thing on the part of the founder. Again, you want to make sure the investors that you want to pitch in are the investor that you vetted, either through your university connections, entrepreneurship circles, other angel investors that you know. And you basically doing a lot of these vetting now online. But now it can be done in a much broader scale. Not that everybody is really responsive and making sure that they have these online video calls and so on.
Right. I found that people are more responsive too right now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I found my employee of my portfolio companies, they're all responding or helping other employees because everybody's basically going through a tough time. So everybody's mm-hmm. just stepping up to help each other.
Yeah, which is good to hear. I know this is still too early, you know, like even though shelter in place has been around for this is our 6th week, you know, do you think investors were kind of like on the holding pattern for a while to figure it out when they're going to make the move with, you know, deploying the capital? And also, have you seen in terms of the downward valuation as well?
That's a very good question. There is definitely less pressure on valuation simply because there's less competition. So if you look at the same time last year, there were a lot of capital chasing deals and chasing everybody wanted to invest in the best entrepreneurs and the best companies. And more competition drive up the valuation, very frothy market, no question in that. So valuation definitely are less pressured. So there's a less upward pressure on valuation. But that's not necessarily a good or bad thing, I would say, because when you have the right match between the investor and the founder, it is basically a given that it has to be a deal that has the financial incentive on both sides that's going to be something that then works for that long-term period that you and the investor, founder and investors are partnered together. Which means that even if the valuations may be not as high as before, not on the opposite side, you may not have to raise as much as before. So in terms of the dilution, the percentage of the company that you have to give away as the founder, you may be on the same boat and on the same footing because you know, the cost of operation has come down relatively. So you have a lot of people working from home. The expenses, the travel expenses, the overhead is less. So you can basically budget more efficiently.
Do you see that more from people who are coming in with their proposal? They ask for less money and you see more efficiency built in their pitch deck already at this time?
You definitely see that people are more cautious about how they are managing the cash flow. And this is true for a new investment or what we communicate with the existing companies in our portfolio. That right now, the first priority is, of course, managing the risk of health, the health risk, and making sure your employees are safe, the workplace, if it's a work from home or if they have to come to work for, let's say it's a lab operation, is safe. And then the second priority after that is the cash for the company. So cash is king. In this environment. So you have to be very careful about how you manage the cash in terms of the capex, in terms of the labor. And that's reflected both in existing portfolio and companies that are raising new rounds. And you see that how they're planning. So before, maybe you had planned to do a fundraise now and then do another raise maybe 12 months from now. Now you plan to do a fundraise now and then the subsequent fundraise maybe 2 years from now because of the environment. And what that means is that you have to manage the cash and project how the use of cash more more efficiently and account for that. So we see that in the market. And at the end, I think for early stage investment, when you look at what investors and founders are partnering together in terms of the financial incentives, there's never a situation that I would say that one way or the other, you have founders giving less of the company or more of the company in exchange for cash, because investors know that also the financial incentive has to be right for the founders to be motivated. So I don't think there is a negative impact from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying earlier about, you know, when this pandemic started, the whole shelter in place happened. I mean, what you're saying is not uncommon. A lot of the investor, first thing they do is trying to figure out about their portfolio companies, how to keep them healthy. Many of them, I hear that they tell all the companies to, like, how can you extend the runway? And what advice do you give company to extend the runway when they're planning to raise their fund originally, like say at the end of summer or the beginning of summer?
Yeah. So, it really varies, I think, Christine, by type of company. So let's use some examples from therapeutics. So therapeutics, you nonetheless, depending on what stage you are, whether it's clinical stage or preclinical, you have some sort of lab operation. And lab operation, you have to have some people in the lab working. So you have to have some, you cannot, for example, be completely work remotely. So you have to pay for, you know, access to the lab, to the benches. But at the same time, you can be more efficient in your planning. So, for example, the therapeutic companies that we have in our portfolio, what we communicate with them is, okay, maybe instead of pursuing two assets at the same time in the preclinical stage and, you know, doing the lab operation on those, maybe we prioritize one. And then the other one, you know, we just put it on a back burner, depending on which one we think is a higher priority, and then that way we can, you know, save half of the lab cost and so on. Other companies, let's say digital health companies, that can be basically software development effort, those can be completely done, you know, remotely. So those are better positioned right now to adopt their workforce and their work environment to the current condition. So you have companies, we have companies in our portfolio that actually people are kind of scattered around the globe. So we have some a developer that was on a visiting trip to their family and now they're kind of stuck in Europe or stuck in Asia and they couldn't come back. But nonetheless, that actually has had almost no impact. The area that's most impacted is where you deal with marketing and sales. So in healthcare particularly, we have some companies that were selling some innovative products to hospitals. I think that's the area that's most impacted right now. So you can imagine that everywhere in the US and globally, hospitals are now focused on the pandemic preparedness, reallocating resources to priorities, and kind of innovation and spending on innovative services and products, unless it's directly impact related to the pandemic. Those type of things kind of take a second seat right now. So those are most impacted. And unfortunately, I think it will take some time for companies that are directly dealing with hospitals in terms of their go-to-market and developing, you know, relationship, bringing a new product to market. Those will take some time to get back to normal.
Do you think with also because of the pandemic, everybody's staying home more? Definitely you see a lot more interest in the telehealth space. What do you see the future in the digital health? I mean, those companies have to sell to providers and to hospitals sometimes.
Yeah, that's a very good question. One of the bright areas right now, it's telehealth. So companies that recently went public, in that area. So for example, One Medical, it's a medical concierge and basically telehealth. Went public earlier this year, and so they see increased demand for their services. Companies that are focusing on mental health, those are also seeing very uptick in their demand. And you see employers now offering those mental health services as they see that their workforce is isolated, and obviously it's a situation that you have an isolated workforce and families that if they unfortunately have to deal with a family member that's impacted by the virus, or just merely because they are working from home and isolated, and that can have negative consequences with regard to mental health. And you see employers now offering those services for mental as a benefit for their employees. Companies like Modern Health, it's not our portfolio company, but one good example of companies that are helping basically people in these times. And going through the employers and making sure the employees have access to these services for mental health. Those are very valuable services right now.
If you can see the future in the next, your next few investment, where would you focus on more, the diagnostic, the digital, or the therapeutic?
Yeah, I think diagnostics absolutely is an area that probably was not getting as much attention before, generally just in terms of statistically how much money is raised by diagnostics companies versus therapeutic companies. And now you see there's a lot of demand for diagnostics. And because of that, and because the demand for the diagnostics is probably going to actually last, and not just during the pandemic, even beyond that, because people will be more mindful and there will be a change of habit. You see real emphasis on investors now getting more excited and getting more basically investing in diagnostic companies. One example in our portfolio, a company called Mammoth Biosciences, which came from University of Berkeley, Professor Jennifer Doudna, who's a pioneer in CRISPR, has developed a CRISPR-based diagnostics platform. So when we invested in the company a couple of years ago, the promise of the platform is that it can detect any virus, any pathogen, as long as you can basically understand the DNA and sequence the DNA of that particular pathogen. And using a simple swab, whether a respiratory or other samples, like a home pregnancy test, and putting the swab in this assay, within 40 minutes, you can have a visual readout, a line that says whether the virus is present in that swab sample or not.
So is that company now somehow participating in this testing offering for the COVID-19, or it's not quite ready yet?
Exactly. So interestingly enough, they actually published a paper in Nature Biotechnology, the peer-reviewed journal, just a few days ago, that they have basically developed this assay. They already have tested in a large study with more than 80 patients. And they showed that the test that, as they described, is a paper test. It's a poem, you know, it can be taken at home with a simple swab and has the predictive power in terms of the both positive and negative, has the predictive power with what CDC offers or has approved with their PCR test. but with the difference that it takes less than 40 minutes and it can be taken at home, and it's very inexpensive. And so now they're actually going to get FDA approval through something called emergency use authorization, which is, you know, obviously related to the emergency situation. And that's a very good example of, you know, a diagnostics company now with this situation that we have. Now those investments, you know, it's a venture-backed company and, you know, being able to step up and help.
Do you think once this whole pandemic, I mean, one day it will be over, do you think the appetite for diagnostics will still be there? Because in the past, it's always the challenge is who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good question. I think at least in the medium term, the answer is it will be a lot of demand. Because until there is a widely available vaccination, which may be at least a couple of years away, become available for COVID-19, we would have a situation that employers, you know, people themselves, they don't want to gather in places unless they're sure that they are not carrying the virus or they have the antibodies. So you will see a demand that will, even after the economy, kind of the reopening of the economy, you see the demand goes beyond that, I believe, in diagnostics. And I think what it does is, not just with the pandemic for coronavirus, but also with what will become a new norm and how the norm of work from home or other situation changes, and people will be much more cognizant of, you know, if something like this could happen again, maybe a different virus, a different mutation of the virus. So you would see that diagnostics platform would get a different type of potentially, you know, a lot of more investments, a lot of more attention from the investment community, and a lot of more interest from entrepreneurs, I think. So I think entrepreneurs that maybe prior to the pandemic were thinking that they want to focus on other areas, but now they still have a good idea about a new diagnostic service, now they're going to pursue because of the value that brings.
I guess everybody, the world is always like a circle. Everybody eventually have a chance.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, there's a lot more interest in the future for diagnostics. I always tell people that if you think your industry is hard, try to be in diagnostics. But I guess, you know, everybody has their moment.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
I want to open to the Q&A. And before I go there, there's people who ask the question about if you meet entrepreneurs for pitches, and the answer is yes. And what's the best way for them to reach out to you? I think you mentioned about if you try to get a warm introduction, you have a higher chance to meet with Ali. That's correct, right?
Absolutely. So a warm introduction always is the best way, both ways. We try to connect to entrepreneurs through warm introduction, and it works best the other way as well. But even outside of that, so for our firm, if you visit our website, dh.vc, there is our email contact there, and there is also a form to submit a pitch deck or submit your information online. And we try our best to get back as soon as possible for the companies that we see have a good fit with us.
So first question from Mar. Do you know any interesting companies in telehealth that you can share with us? And what's their business models look like? Why is it interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned one of our investments, company called Viz AI. I described briefly what they do, but it's a very, very innovative company. So one of our thesis in generally digital health is that you may have a cool technology, but you need to be a complete workflow solution. So things in healthcare are usually very hard to change because by definition, healthcare is very sensitive. If you deal with well-being of people. So from providers to payers to patients themselves, everybody is risk averse. So introducing new services and new workflows then requires that you have a end-to-end a workflow solution that's basically integrating with the existing standard care and being able to really show the value. So it's not just about the technology, it's about the workflow, what I mean. Viz AI is a company that I mentioned. What they do is they actually were the first company that got the FDA approval for a computer assisted triage. Basically, it's a software program that helps a neurovascular clinician to decide whether a patient had a stroke and whether the patient need to be operated in an emergency. So stroke is a very serious situation because it can have a life-lasting consequences in terms of disability and so on. So if a person has a stroke, for the first-line responders, this could be paramedic, if they can connect to a neurosurgeon quickly to then be able to determine whether the patient needs a surgery, that's a huge value. Now, in the current standard of care or previous standard of care, that's very hard. You have to take a CT scan, the computer tomography, and then send it to radiologists, and radiologists look at it and then send it to the neurosurgeon if they decide that's appropriate, and that usually takes a few days at least. Now, Viz AI, which is basically an app, what it does, it connects to the database to be able to digest those CT scans, and then quickly, as the first responders are treating the patient, be able to determine whether using an AI for image analysis of those CT scan, whether the patient has a stroke risk, and if they had an occlusion of the brain vessels. And then send a message right away, actually a notification to the neurosurgeon that we have such a patient and you should be notified, and this is the scan CT for you to review, and if this patient needs to get a surgery right away. And that's basically a whole end-to-end workflow solution turned out to be very, very valuable for the patient, for the first responders, and for the neurosurgeon as a digital health service that was enabled by the technology, but actually enables for the patient to get a better care and for the provider to be able to provide that care with much more efficiency. So Viz AI is a company that has been developing the service for some years now. They got their FDA approval 2018, and now they're implementing this. And it's been a fantastic, fantastic opportunity to be part of their journey as an example of one of the companies you mentioned, Christine.
Yeah. So their business model is like, who's paying for their services? Is it a payer or the provider?
So you can think of the benefit both ways. So it is for the payer, as I mentioned. If a person has a life-lasting consequence like disability, obviously that's very costly. So for the payer, they would be happy to pay for this type of service. For the provider also, though, let's say if you have a neurosurgeon that their utilization is below their optimal, so they can perform additional surgeries per day, and this is a way for them to be able to get those patients. So for them also, this is something valuable. So actually both of them, both the payers and the providers, are part of the value add and the value proposition, and both of them are contributing to the revenue for the company. Now, the beneficiary, the patient, there's no cost to them, obviously, and they just get a better care, better service by having this service implemented.
Okay, I have another question from John. What is your general checklist of requirements before investing, say, a smaller round of $500,000, be it in diagnostic versus, say, telehealth?
Very good question. So to your question, John, it really depends on the subsector. So let's start with the diagnostics and therapeutics, kind of close. So those areas that are, I would say, scientific heavy. So you probably would have, or maybe have a scientific breakthrough coming from translational research or some other breakthrough. Obviously having an IP protection, being able to get that through the university or where it was originated, that's usually a starter. So you want to make sure that that IP is protected and has the right basically framework around it with regard to the existing IP out there. that's the starting point. For digital health companies that are usually around software services, that is less of importance in the beginning, because it's usually about the product and the end product and how well it's developed. And of course, in the initial versions, you have different revisions, but how was the product developed and ultimately what is going to be the business model? For both cases, I would say for therapeutic diagnostic as well as digital health companies, for early stage, at the end of the day, it's really about the team. Because what we've seen over and over again is you can always change the direction of the company with regard to the core technology, with regard to the product, but you can never change the team easily. The same thing as you can never change the investors easily. So what I mean by that is when you partner, the founders partner with investors, investor partner with founders, that is usually the longest or the least changeable variable in the equation. So you want to make sure that you have the right match there. You have the right team with the right investor matched up. So the team, people talk about the team market fit or the team product fit. That's the same thing as team investor fit. And there's a lot of chemistry there. So it may not be easy to qualify, but it's something that definitely both sides, investors and founders, should look for. And that's an absolute must. And then, as I mentioned, IP, technology, product, those are also very important. But those are things that, at the end of the day, you can change if you have to.
Okay. This is a question from Vikas. And to follow up on your question about, the team is important. And his question is, why is the team required to get investment? Why can't we refine the idea and then build or buy a team? What's your thought about that?
So that's a very good question. As it happens, specifically in healthcare, that is a model that is sometimes often to do, in the sense that you have venture companies, including ourselves, DHVC, that incubate a new company, which means is, so I'm an investor, I have some idea or I see some need in the market for some particular service, and I have some idea, and I basically incubate a new company and then go and try to recruit the right person for that team. So that could be also, let's say if you're an angel investor, and you have an idea and then you can start a company and then go and look for the right team to come and develop that or pursue that, do the R&D full time. So that's quite common, especially in healthcare and in therapeutics, diagnostics. And the reason it's common is the development process for therapeutics and diagnostics for a long, it takes a long time, obviously. You know, it's highly regulated. You have to go through FDA process. It's scientifically heavy. And what it means is for a long time, you'd be kind of working inside your four walls. You don't have to do any sales, any marketing. So as long as you have the capital and you have the right team that you put to do to pursue that, you can do that and get incubate the company. And then when it comes to once you pass the regulatory approval, then you go to market and then you are going to go to the next phase. As opposed to, let's say, digital health or traditional enterprise consumer companies, that's from day one, you have to go to market. So when you have to go to market, then it's a kind of different story because then you have to do a team from day one that does that.
Okay, and next question is from Hanel. How do you anticipate providers to change their operating and or business models given the current pandemic? And what startup or services do you see being best positioned to facilitate this transition?
Yeah, very good question. But we talked about it a little bit in the beginning. It's really about how you handle your employees first and foremost in terms of safety. So workplace safety is a huge issue, and I think actually still underappreciated. As the economy reopens, there will be a lot of anxiety. There will be a lot of worry among employees. They have to go back to their place of work. Maybe companies don't open 100%, maybe some percentage of workforce in phases go back to work. But still, that's going to be a very, very important issue. So workplace safety is, I think, it's the first and foremost that every CEO, every founder, every company has to think about. So how I'm going to handle with the social distancing guidelines, how I'm going to handle Dumiga. Do I have to provide the PPE, the protective equipment? for my employees and how I make sure that they have the right protection in the workplace. So those are very important things to think about. And those are matters that would be potentially require capital. So as far as the allocating and prioritizing the capital, I think that's one of the first things to consider. The second thing is, of course, cash and cash runway, in the sense that, okay, now that the economy reopens and you go back to work and you kind of go back to some level of normalcy, how you can manage the cash, how you can extend your runway as much as possible. So what we tell our portfolio companies is focus on a few things. First, if you are in a situation that you unfortunately have to think about rationalizing your workforce, this is actually the right time to do it. You don't want to do it in such a way that you you basically spend the money that you have and then after several months you realize that, oh, now you have to do it. Because at that point, you already have consumed your cash runway and then you're in a worse situation in the sense that maybe you have to let go of more people as opposed to if you have done it early. So those type of hard decisions that may have to happen, unfortunately, as a responsible founder, it's better to do it earlier than later. So that's one of the decisions or one of the advices we give to our founders. And unfortunately, it's a tough time, really. And we try to be as much as helpful to help them to raise capital or to find alternatives, but that could be one potential outcome in terms of the headcount of the company. The other thing is don't focus on marketing and sales at this time. Really, because if you think about, digital health, let's use it as an example I mentioned, if you have to sell to hospitals, if you have to sell to channel partners for different type of services and products, unfortunately, now is the time that that's very hard to do. So no matter how much money you may throw at it right now, you may not get that return. So might as well protect that cash that you have and don't invest that in sales and marketing right now. Focus on much less capital intensive ways and then use that cash in the appropriate time later once economy situations are better. So that's the second advice. And the last advice that we give companies is it's always an opportunity when things are hard. When there is a lot of capital out there, it's easy to solve problem with capital. When you have a lot of investors chasing you and putting money in your company, you can throw money at any kind of trouble and any kind of problem and then have a simple solution. And that kind of at some level goes against the nature of innovation. Innovation usually comes and born out of necessity. And to that sense, now is actually a time for everybody from investors and entrepreneurs to when they think about a business model, when they think about a technology, when they think about a company, to think of, okay, now with this new environment, how can we be more innovative than before and find a better solution? How can we provide a better service at a lower cost? Like how can we provide, develop our product less expensively and so on? And those are type of things that usually during hard times, and there are many examples, of course, in the previous recession of companies that born out of that necessity. You think about, this is a famous example, company like Stripe or Square, which are related to payments. Those were completely born out of the necessity for small companies, small, medium business sized companies, not being able to do the businesses as usual during the 2009 financial crisis. And the necessity for those type of business models and being able to do the payments online with a Stripe or doing the point of sales with a Square then completely changed the whole landscape for small and medium-sized businesses. So you can see that, again, with this type of situation, now you have the new norms from work from home, social distancing, and there will be innovation for sure that comes out of this. And it's really upon the shoulders of investors, entrepreneurs, and by extension, the investors to capture those type of opportunities.
Keep observing, keep looking very hard for potential unmet needs. I wanted to include one question that this is more for an advice for graduating students. You see that, it's a challenging time to graduate around this time. The question is, what advice would you give somebody who is a graduating student looking to go into entrepreneurship, either founding or starting a company or you know, should they consider other option instead of doing a startup in this kind of market? Should they go to a larger company instead?
So that's a very good question. And I think there's going to be factors, economic factors beyond, or even other factors that beyond current, just current situation that may impact that. So it really depends. Let's say, for example, if you're an international student, right? So if you're an international student, there may be limitation in terms of the work permits, in terms of what you can be able to do as a founder. So then the answer may be different. If you are a, you know, a not international, if you're domestic, a founder, so may have more more resources and more freedom. So I think really depends on a particular case by case for the founder, entrepreneur, and themselves, and also for the type of industry. I think again, entrepreneurship and innovation is something that it always lasts longer and always transcends, whether it's economic or other type of things. So I think the best advice is if you have an idea, if you have, let's say, if you're graduating from school, if you have an idea, you're doing some research in your school, in your grad school, you have a breakthrough technology, a breakthrough science, or some innovative approach to an unmet need. If you have an idea, don't wait for, or don't delay that, because the chances are somebody else may beat you to it, right? So that's the great thing about entrepreneurship. That's always competition pushes you forward. So try as much as possible to, you know, with the confidence that you would have in your innovation, to pursue investors. And investors are always fascinated when they see an entrepreneur that's so determined for solving a problem, for bringing a new solution to the market, and you would be successful.
Well, that looks like our last question. And I want to thank you for taking the time to share with us about DHPC and some of your insight. And hopefully this is helpful to a lot of people. And have a good afternoon, everybody. And it's great seeing you all.
Thank you, Christine. Fantastic to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.